Greetings once again to each and all. This is the Maine Turton, John Lash, recording on the 12th of July, 2015. I send this recorded message out to each and all, those of you who can still stand to listen, but especially those of you who can stand for truth when you hear it. Now, I haven't recorded anything in a while, and I honestly don't know if I will be recording anymore, as I said in a recent message to the general mailing list. I've had the occasion to go back and review some of my teachings, which is what they are, that can be found on the internet in these MP3 files. In particular, I've been looking back into the Gnostic Sabotage series that I started in November of 2012. I was really surprised to listen to the 5 talks in that series. It reminded me that I do come across in peak form at moments. It would appear that a good number of the navigator briefings of the GNE, not all by any means, but a good number of them, demonstrate the teacher in peak form. And to be honest with you, if I can't match or exceed what I've done already, I ain't gonna do nothing. And right now, I'm not sure that I can. I'm not sure that I can speak again, although my heart is overflowing and overburdened with things I wish to say and with truth such as I know it, both the relative truth and the absolute truth, to refer to an old Buddhist distinction between Sambuddhi Satya and Paramatta Satya, both forms of truth compel me to speak, but I don't know if I can, because I just don't know physically if I can do it, if I can dance that dance. But to help myself get started, I decided to make a recording, which is simply a reading of something I wrote. Now, this essay, to be found on metahistory.org, was written 10 years ago this month. Can you imagine that? 10 fucking years ago, I wrote this. That was 3 years before I got to Terma. It was a year before Not in His Image came out. So I'm going to read you this essay just to warm myself up. It's a warm-up act. I'm going to see if I can get back into the tonal, which is to say the oral frequency of incarnation, you see, so that I can instruct properly, skillfully, you know, with upaya, skillful means. The topics that are on my mind right now in this hot, hot Spanish summer of 2015, and when the world teeters on the edge of World War III and worse, the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organizations into the military and executive functions of the USSA, and worse. As I drag myself through these hot summer days, most of the time sleeping at the hottest part of the day, laying out on the terrace with the cats in the cool, balmy air of the evening, I have two primary subjects that keep floating to the top of my attention, as it were. I have about 8 or 10 things in my attention right now, which is too much for a man to handle. I always try to scale it down to 8, but I can't. I can't. The process of handover is proceeding, however, and that's the good news. I've set myself the near impossible goal to complete handover by my birthday, December of this year. If I can complete handover, then I can confine myself to 8 points of exposition, and I can handle what comes through. I'm not at that place yet, and hence the hesitation and doubt about what I'm even doing at this moment. But let me tell you about the two subjects that are foremost in my mind among the many things I could bring forth to you. One of them is the Lucifer-Sophia question. The true Lucifer is Sophia, is the title of a piece I'm working on metahistory. Tending to go back to writing, I don't really know if I can continue to speak, you know. I can speak to people who are in front of me, but I don't know if I can speak this way anymore. The other subject is the one pertinent to the essay which I'm going to read now and record. I give the title of that subject as follows: The Tragedy of the Mother. So, bear that little title in mind. Savor it on your tongue as you listen to this reading. And at the end of the reading, I'll come back to that theme and perhaps have another comment or two to add at the conclusion of this recording. Okay, here goes. Title of this essay is A Sheaf of Cut Wheat. And you can find it on madehistory.org in the category of Gnostic under the subcategory of Telestics. The essay begins with the essay has a subtitle, A Short Refutation of Hologram Theory by Way of the Eleusinian Mysteries. And it opens with a short indented paragraph, which I suppose, according to my mood at that time, was meant to be some kind of disclaimer or qualification regarding what was to come. Remember, I wrote this over a year and a half before Nod in His Image came out in November 2006, which contains a chapter of the same title and more or less reiterates the same message. So, I don't know why, but some language just comes up when it comes up. The muse can be a fickle creature, but she is infinitely faithful in her own way. What starts as a short refutation of a modern theory, so bloodless as it is hardly worth a snort, takes me back to the heart of the mysteries. For those who find the language at the top of this piece forbidding, male, abstract, lifelessly and heartlessly intellectual, try to imagine this. I am not a first century man enslaved to his intellect and worshipping it at a computer terminal. I am a lonely hunter in a cave, carving a line of delicate ciphers on a bone-white antler. The hologram, or holograph, theory of consciousness was originally proposed by Carl Pribram and later developed by writers as diverse as Michael Talbot, Mysticism and the New Physics, and David Icke, author of numerous books on alien intrusion. Roughly, it states that the universe is a holographic projection of our minds, or of our brain functions, or some combination of the two, if we hold mind and brain to be distinct, as some proponents of this theory do, while others do not. Parenthesis. For a good summary of brain-mind theory in the context of Prebrum's ideas, see Marilyn Ferguson, The Aquarian Conspiracy. End parentheses. In short, the theory implies that my consciousness itself produces the world of which and in which I am conscious, yet without being conscious of how I produce it. Bear with me for a moment while I do a little goat-footed dance around this tricky notion. Subheading, a short refutation. To get going, I will frame the proposition in a different syntax using the key concept of perception. If the universe is a result of my perception, then my perception of the universe, which belongs to the dynamic of the universe in toto, including its own subjective and objective dimensions, is also as a result of my perception. Hence, my perception is a result of, or is created by, my perception. The syntax of this hologram theory of consciousness is clearly redundant. The universe is the result of my perception of a universe that already includes the perception that produces it. This proposition is self-negating and leads nowhere. Subheading, more novel syntax. Now, if I assume that my perception of the universe is given to me by the universe through psychophysical operations that both encompass and exceed my awareness, then I can say that my perception comes from the universe, and so my experience of the universe will change if my perception shifts, if I, quote, receive, unquote, the universe differently. It may be appropriate, then, to consider a revised syntax that includes perception and reception, and contrast them, in order to dance, gleefully, I might add, beyond the limits of holographic theory. The novel syntax yields a couple of deft corollary propositions. 1. Reception predetermines perception. We perceive the universe depending on how and what we receive from it as signals, information, sensory input. 2. Perception filters reception. The way we can receive the universe is affected by the way we perceive it. The perception-reception dynamic clearly equates with known Gaian feedback processes. Following the alchemical rule, quote, let thine operations be guided by nature, unquote, this syntax affords a description of consciousness interacting with the cosmos, that is, the mind-universe coupling that conforms to the self-evident phenomena of nature. A shift in my perception changes my relation to the source of my perception, which may be assumed to be the universe, but it does not change the universe itself. The novel syntax permits us to make clear distinctions we would otherwise overlook, or it even spontaneously generates such distinctions. With the stated qualification, quote, which may be assumed to be the universe, unquote, referring to the source of our perception, we are able to conceive that the source of our perception of the universe could be other than the universe itself. This is one line of inquiry to follow, distinct from the line I am taking here. I would call this variation, assuming that the source of our perception of the universe is not the universe or in the universe we perceive, the Vedantic line. Vedantic approach would be a better term. This view is typical of Advaita Vedanta or Hindu metaphysical non-dualism. By contrast, I am taking the tantric line or approach called Mayavada Vedanta. Sounds like music, doesn't it? Which assumes that the source of our perception of the universe resides in the universe perceived, in the ensemble of forces and phenomena called Maya, that really and truly comprise the cosmos at large. Subheading, mind, nature, complementarity. A shift in my perception changes the mind-universe dynamic, but it does not directly change the universe. At most, we might suppose that a change in the mind would affect a change in the mind-universe ensemble. This supposition follows Bateson, for instance, on the complementarity of mind and nature. We assume a mind-nature ensemble, a structural coupling, because this is primary to every moment of experience in the physical world. We know that a change of mind, outlook, attitude, reasoning, will change the coupling and affect a different relation to nature for the human subject, the possessor of mind, but it does not directly change nature. I would propose Bateson's mind-nature complementarity as a test frame for developing novel theoretical syntax for the mind-universe coupling. By nature, I mean the realm of the senses operative in the biosphere, the planetary habitat. This realm extends to cosmic dimensions because we have direct perceptual evidence of distant stars and one visible external galaxy, M31, the Andromeda Galaxy. Bateson follows the alchemical rule and often writes as if he were the reincarnated Goethe, taking a second opportunity to develop his theory of morphological perception, Goethe's theory. Goethe, of course, was also deeply inspired by Western alchemical arts. The persistent error of hologram theory and related types of theoretic syntax, cf. David Icke and other examples of magical thinking, is the assumption that our perception of the universe originates with us, the percipients. I consider that getting past this assumption is one of the great, genuinely transcendent syntactical shifts that can lead to an utterly different way to encounter the cosmos. The Perceptual Implications of Gaia, an article written by David Abram, whom I met in Santa Fe briefly many years ago, was published in The Ecologist in 1985. It is the single most outstanding statement on Gaia theory in terms of cognitive science, gnosis, and noetics. Abram's article is concise and highly elusive, leaving many points to be developed more thoroughly, as he does to some extent in The Spell of the Sensuous. This article is a signal flare that cannot be ignored, for it touches the ultimate revelation of the mysteries, the sheaf of cut wheat. Abram says that perception is, quote, a reciprocal phenomenon organized as much by the surrounding world as by oneself, end quote. This statement points to the mind-nature coupling and suggests a two-way dynamic, by contrast to the one-way perceiving of the world that does not affect the way it is perceived, but merely offers a spectacle to be observed. Anticipating eco-psychology by a good decade, Abram also says that, quote, the psyche is a property of the ecosystem as a whole, unquote, rather than a distinct and separate entity, subjective and disembodied, a wholly denatured entity. Finally, Abram curtly advises that we get beyond the, quote, the conviction that one's mind is anything other than the body itself, end quote. And amen, brother. Abram's three points are intimately related to the experience of initiation in the mysteries, especially the entheogenic initiation at Eleusis that culminated in the Hierophant holding up before the initiates a sheaf of cut wheat. Subtitle heading, The Rarian Fields. The mysteries were schools for coevolution with Gaia, the Magna Marta, Mater, the Great Mother, the Magna Mater. The Latin orator Cicero, known to have been initiated at Eleusis, wrote, quote, in the mysteries one learns more about nature than about the gods, end quote. That is from De Natura Deorum, Book 1. Chapter, whatever. With the myth of the fallen Sophia at the center of their world vision, the Gnostikoi had to continually plunge themselves into deep sentient immersion in nature in order to keep their communion with the goddess alive and open-ended, and attune their minds to Gaia's transhuman purposes. The method they followed for the ultimate learning experience, and you can bet your booty on that, was conferred by the goddess herself, as described in the Homeric hymn to Demeter. She taught them to minister her rites and reveal to them her glorious mysteries, which are impossible to transgress, or to pry into, or to divulge, for so great is one's awe of the divine that it stops the tongue. Those whose tongues were muted were the Misdei from Muein, from the Greek verb Muein, to speak in a muted voice or through compressed lips. These were the participants in the rites. By a literary trick, the Homeric hymn reveals what it says the Misdei cannot divulge. Early in the hymn, when Demeter, the grain goddess of Eleusis, appears in human guise to Queen Metanira, the queen offers her a drink of mead, wine sweet with honey. But Demeter, or Demeter, refuses it, saying, rather enigmatically, that it was unlawful for her to drink that potion. Instead, she instructs Metanira to make another brew of water with barley and tender pennyroyal. The barley drink is the Kikian, the entheogenic potion drunk at the greater mysteries of Eleusis and elsewhere in the mystery precincts throughout the classical world and around the Mediterranean basin. At Eleusis in ancient times, barley grew in the Rarian fields that bordered the town. Mysteriously, some of the crop was known as white barley, even though it was colored by the ergo fungus Claviceps purpurea that infested the kernels and turned them purplish black. Working with G. Gordon Wasson, Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann, who discovered LSD, showed that the Kikian of Eleusis, the drink ordered by Demeter, was a psychedelic potion whose active properties derive from the fungal entheogen, ergot. Subheading, The Mystery Light. Note, some of the following is from a draft of my book, Dreaming Sophia, forthcoming from Chelsea Green in March 2006. Of course, that turned out to be not in his image, published in November 2006. Fragments from the pediment at Eleusis present three images that epitomize the organization, method, and supernatural source of illumination in the mysteries. One of these images relates to the account of the heresy hunter Hippolytus, who reports an eyewitness detail that has baffled scholars through the ages. Just at the moment they emerged from the telesterion, the inner sanctum of initiation, initiates were shown by the Hierophant a sheaf of wheat in silence reaped. In this gesture was revealed the great, the marvelous, the most perfect secret for one initiated into the mystic truths. Hence, the testimony from Refutation of All Heresies, Book 5, Chapter 3. The architrave frieze of the Lesser Propylaea at Eleusis, Plate 57 in George Milanus' book, Eleusis and the Eleusinian Mysteries, shows the sheaf of wheat, the biological source of illumination, on the left. Next to it is the 16-petal rosette with interior and exterior petals. This was a symbol of the organization of the mystery cells, consisting of 16 adepts, 8 men and 8 women, as depicted in the winged serpent bowl of the Orphics and in the Pietroesa bowl from Romania. See the mysteries in the Eranos yearbook series, Bollingen, edited by Joseph Campbell. The inner petals of the rosette represent the Misdei, whose work was dedicated to developing the instructions received by periodic and ever-deepening initiations. while the outer petals represent the 8 misti dedicated to transmitting externally what was learned within the cell. These roles were periodically rotated, allowing the adepts to concentrate on different tasks on different shifts. The shifts were seasonal and reflected the ages-old initiatory technique of guiding society by goddess-oriented rites of death and renewal, including, I might add, a close observation of the lunar cycles. Temples were oriented to the seasonal points so that these rites could be enacted in situ. Before the temples were built, all of this was done in open nature, in the majestic setting of megalithic circles, dolmens, and menhirs under the circling stars. The third image on the Eleusis pediment, resembling a cylindrical urn, represents the current of the mystery light, which cannot actually be represented in any such abstract manner, but conceived as a massive downpour that forms into round standing columns. The telesterion, or inner sanctum, where initiates encountered the light, was composed of many columns. The missae, in an altered state, moved among them as if dancing through an immobile Niagara of soft, molten marble. The sound of the motionless falls was immaculate silence, as deep as a bottomless well of rolling thunder. Mystery texts found among the Nag Hammadi material compare the supernal light to a fountain overflowing with a soft rush of massive currents. In the discourse of the 8th and the 9th, on the 8th and the 9th, the initiate exclaims, "I am mind, yet I see another mind, the one that animates my soul. I see the one that moves me to pure forgetfulness of myself. I have found the origin of the power above all powers that has no beginning. I see a fountain overflowing with life." Those who can hold attention on this wellspring of light enter the assembly of the Ogduad, the 8th, a mystery code term for members of the receiving cell represented by the 8 interior petals. The Apocryphon of John and the Sophia of Jesus Christ in Nag Hammadi describe torrents of mystic illumination depicted in their locked modality by the stylized pillar on the Eleusinian pediment. The mystis in the Sophia of Jesus Christ, passage 115, praises the beauty of the light that shines without casting shadow, full of indescribable joy and ebullience. The shadowless light is white and visible, manifesting everywhere, permeating all things. It is not a light that shines on material things, but a soft, white, substantial luminosity in which matter floats. The mysteries were celebrated at night because it was easier to bring neophytes into the presence of the light with normal sense perception muted by darkness. The celebrants were not dazzled by hocus-pocus display of flaming torches, as some ancient reports would have it. While wandering in the telesterion, they were carefully and selectively shown a pillar with the aid of a torch, because the mystery light had to be observed and absorbed in small, gentle doses. Initiates saw not only the pillar, but the luminous substance in which what they saw was embedded, organic light, as I propose to call it. The organic light is active, aware, and capable of communicating with those who witness it. Quote, "The light was full of thought and hearing and word," end quote. The paraphrase of Shem, Nag Hammadi, Codex 7, Book 1, Passage 1.30. Its physical mass, known as the white stone or philosopher's stone in alchemical traditions that preserves some aspects of the mysteries, is paradoxically superdense and mass-free, indicating a state of high porosity. The organic light wells up from material things as if it were a boundless billow of soft, luminous nougat, yet all appearances and objects remain intact, floating serenely in the supernatural luminosity that infills them. The apoptia, seeing aided by the Hierophant, was carefully gauged to meet the capacities of the supplicant. The autopsia, direct and independent seeing of the divine light, came in its own time to those who had trained their powers of attention for it. Gnostics called themselves the standing race because they were able to behold the organic light while standing upright and absorb the force of the massive telluric currents passing between earth and the heavens. Standing in the undulant, opalescent currents, sober, steady, and attentive, with eyes open, they refrained from hallucination and received the download of Gaian intelligence, an influx from the planetary mind. Instruction by the light was the perennial method of the mysteries and its most closely guarded secret. Initiates taught what they learned from the light, but they were bound by a vow of silence not to disclose how they had learned it. Subheading, Cognitive Ecstasy. The supreme secret of the Eleusinian mysteries was demonstrated by the gesture of the Hierophant, who held up the sheaf of barley, freshly cut. Demeter initiated the rites of the grain, but this mythological statement is usually understood to mean that she was a deity to whom the introduction of agriculture was attributed. But it's not agriculture that the Mystae were practicing, however. The mystery of the grain appears to concern agriculture, and Eleusis was situated in the Rarian fields where barley grew in great abundance. But it was the effect of fungal ergot in the head of the barley that constituted the mystery, not the mundane and onerous chore of farming. Each stalk of wheat contains in its head the seed to reproduce itself. Likewise, the Eleusinian initiates, gathered into a group or a sheaf, contained in their minds the seed knowledge to reproduce what they knew, to transmit initiated wisdom to future generations. In the kernel of the grain resides its reproductive power, but also, due to the fungus of ergot, its revelatory power. The Mystae understood the two powers, biological and mystical, as a unity. Through rites of sacred biology, they participated, body and mind, in a higher type of generation. The harvesting of the grain, for it was cut grain they saw in the hand of the Hierophant, revealed to the Mystae the nature of their own cognitive activity and reminded them as well of their sacred commitment to teach according to the method by which they learned. Technically, this method may be called cognitive ecstasy, the knowing of things in rapturous attention by deep, sentient immersion in the natural world and the bodily senses. This is also a good definition of gnosis in entheogenic terms. There is another aspect to this graphic symbolism, if one wishes to call it that. The cutting of the grain was contrasted to the spectacle of the Rarian fields full of golden grain, rippling in the first light of day as the initiates emerged from the Telesterion. They saw the cut sheaf, and beyond it, the rippling fields of mature wheat, where the greater mysteries were celebrated in the autumn just before the harvest. And in both perceptions they saw themselves, because they were harvested in being initiated. They could provide spiritual nourishment for many people, even for many generations. Yet the people they were to nourish did not eat the harvested, i.e. infected wheat, as the initiates did. They just ate bread. And there's a further dimension of symbolism in the Hierophant's act. By holding up the cut sheaf, he showed the initiates not only who they were, but what they had come to know through instruction by the light, the key illuminist insight. As the wheat is given to us by Demeter, so is our cognition of the natural world, the place where it grows. The moment they emerge from direct counter with the mystery light, the revelation intentionally given to the initiates was the certainty that cognition of the external world is given externally through the power of the earth goddess, Demeter. In awe and gratitude, they understood that the altered state undergone in illumination was accessible due to the entheogenic mixture they ingested, due to its biochemical properties, and in the same moment they realized that their capacity to perceive normally was likewise given by an external agency, the Earth Goddess, whom we today call Gaia. They realized where their cognition was grounded, now that they had her mind. The certainty that cerebral cognition, our way of knowing the world, is given to us externally is a sublime and rapturous experience, the signature of initiated awareness. And I might add, no one who has not had this experience and can deliberately and repeatedly have it deserves to call themselves initiated. This experience cannot be faked, nor can it be desecrated. As the Homeric hymn says, the ancient rites of the grain are impossible to transgress or to pry into or to divulge. In describing instruction by the organic light, I could be said to divulge these ancient mysteries, but not really. Why not? Because I merely describe a learning process. And although I do divulge how the initiates learned, which as far as I know, no one has ever done before in the course of history. So there it is, folks. You read it first on the internet. I do not divulge the essential aspect of this experience. Granted, I am saying more than anyone has ever said before, but I am still leaving the sacrosanct truth unsaid. Subheading, sentient immersion. The Mistei realized when they beheld the cut sheaf of barley, what they had already learned by initiation. But with that graphic act, they were imprinted as a group and sealed together into the sacred moment. Their initiated understanding is consistent with the three elements of cognitive science proposed by Abrams in his lucid essay. That perception is, quote, a reciprocal phenomenon organized as much by the surrounding world as by oneself, quote, was realized directly in initiation, and then some. The Mistei, in cognitive ecstasy, understood that this phenomenon is reciprocal, yes, but rather like the reciprocity in which I give a part of my fortune to someone who has nothing, and we spend it together. They realize that the entire cognitive field of human beings and of all sentient life is set up and supported by the external world as a projection of the living intelligence of the planet. And Abram's words, a property of the ecosystem as a whole. Coming out of the most sublime experience given to the human species, the Mistei realized that they were not different from the wheat standing in the nearby fields. The arrogance of knowing what they knew, hear, was counterbalanced by the understanding of what they were, seen in Gaian terms. In receiving her mind, they became selfless instruments of nature comparable to plants growing from the ground. On top of it all, the conviction that one's mind is anything other than the body itself would not have ever been to them a conviction, but a vivid, direct, irrefutable reality. Gnosis is full body psychosomatic illumination. You do not see the organic light in your head or in your mind or even in your heart. You encounter it with your entire body standing upright. Subheading, Serpents of Wisdom. The mysteries taught a scientific truth that could well serve for the founding proposition of noetic science today. The Magna Mater the Dea Mater, who is also Maya, supports cognition of the natural world through the instrument of the human brain in a particular reductive way, but more dynamically and expansively through the entire body-mind complex. The Devi, as Gaia Maya is called in devotional language, does not merely provide the human brain for cognition. She actively reproduces our perception of the world through the brain. Carl Pribram's holographic brain theory and its correlates attempt to describe this dynamic, but unfortunately without reference to the grounding presence of the goddess. Experiential knowledge of the reproduction that Gaia effectuates, reproduction in quotes, via the brain and body together as the sacred legacy of the mysteries, or was the sacred legacy of the mysteries, still is. Gnostics rejected biological reproduction in favor of this transcendental yet body-based miracle. Rapture before the organic light is intensely sexual, divinely and incomparably sensuous, yet it arouses no desire for carnal union. The body entire and sexually enlightened, to coin a phrase, is the instrument of higher awareness in gnosis, cognitive ecstasy. The Kikyon does not produce this ecstasy. Contact with the light does it every time. The anthropogenic brew taken at Eleusis does not induce a state of consciousness for encountering the light. It merely removes the blocks, what blocks reception to it. Recall the novel syntax above, namely ego fixation, self-concern, and the illusion of separation. If I might add here a simple, blood simple, child simple analogy. If you're standing in front of a window pane and you want to look at the landscape outside, but there is a glare of light coming over your shoulder that casts a glare on the window pane that doesn't allow you to see through. The entheogenic plants remove the glare of ego from the pane of your perception. Ego death and rapturous surrender to the living sensorium of the natural world are the hallmarks of Gnostic practice. This is as far from the hype of the God-self equation as you can get. Yet nothing is more divine than standing in the presence of the organic light. Teleste, who underwent ego death and entered full body trance, often represented their experience in serpentine imagery because the mystery light engages Kundalini, the serpent power. Gnostic writings refer to the divine Sophia having serpent form, like DNA. Kundalini is a kind of labile extract of the organic light. Sophia's opalescent current deposited in the human organism. In shamanic trance, the initiate often encounters a magical serpent who can appear externally an independent entity as well as internally a serpentine organism that stretches from head to bowels. Kekrop's hero, O king, thou who at thy feet are serpent-shaped, intones the Greek poet, cited by Jane Ellen Harrison. Praise be to Jane. In Themis, which is a rich repository of mystery lore. In a famous image, Demeter hands the divine child of the mysteries to Kekrops, the serpentine man who represents the lineage of male shrine guardians at Eleusis. Kekrops holds in his left hand the sheaf of sacramental grain and gestures with his right hand, finger to his lips, to indicate the status of the mystes. A sheaf of wheat in silence reaped. The dual form of Kekrops, human above and serpent below, represents the fusion of the human body with the serpent power of the Divine Mother. Embrace and embrace of the most exquisite tenderness. The initiates of the mysteries were serpents of wisdom, Kundalini adepts and devotees of Gaia Sophia, who must not by any account be confounded with the reptilian predators of planetary folklore today. Initiates were, in fact, humanity's main line of defense against the non-human intruders known to Gnostics as Archons, and today known as reptilians, greys, ETs, EBEs, and so forth. Non-initiates who reported on the Eleusinian mysteries believed that the rites were intended to celebrate and thank the mother goddess Demeter for giving the know-how of agriculture to humanity. That was certainly not the way the Teleste viewed them. In the first place, agriculture was a human discovery and not a divinely inspired endowment. In the second place, non-initiates celebrated the popular image of Demeter, an agricultural deity, and ignored her occult role as the Devi Maya Shakti, the divine mother who makes the manifest worlds appear to sense-endowed creatures living in those worlds. Maya means to measure, to make appear in increments, to dimensionalize. Dea Mater is the exact equivalent to Maya Shakti in Mayavada Vedanta, the school of Tantra that closely parallels the mysteries. Tantricas assert that the universe is manifested physically in a manner that conforms to your capacity to perceive it sensorially. Repeat. Tantricas assert that the entire universe, in all its phenomena, from galaxies to buttercups, is manifested physically in a manner that conforms to your capacity to perceive it sensorially. This is the primary noetic principle, common to Gnosis and Tantra Vidya or Mayavada Vedanta. The power to dimensionalize is one with the power to make things appear. Hence, everything in the universe appears in dimensional formats, in a graduated scale of organic and inorganic forms, in internesting fractal scales, if you want to get fancy about it. To risk a pun, these scales are facets on the body of the serpent mother. Initiates at Eleusis realized how Gaia, the planetary intelligence, scales down her reproductive activities to match the modalities that can be cognized by the human brain. She reproduces the world for you at every moment so that it appears to be the product of your perception, an inner-generated construct of your own mind, even though the perceptual act comes to you and is sustained externally. The gesture of the sheaf of cut wheat is an example of what may be called functional symbolism, an object or image that symbolizes a process in nature and at the same time demonstrates the very process it symbolizes. For instance, the alchemical tree is a functional symbol of the atmospheric sheath of the earth in which trees effectuate the process of photosynthesis. The tree both symbolizes the atmospheric sheath in its totality and actually functions in the environment it symbolizes. The method of teaching the mysteries was to explain nature by functional symbols, not by allegories and metaphors, and certainly not by abstractions that indicate one thing by reference to another thing. Holographic theory or holograph theory cannot come anywhere close to doing this. The essay concludes with an image of the Orphic bowl sanctuary of the winged serpent, as it was titled by Joseph Campbell. And this is a rare instance that shows the 16 initiates of a Gnostic cell, naked, with their feet together, which was a communal ceremony they practiced. The actual artifact is a ceremonial bowl carved of alabaster for communal ingestion of the Kikion. JLL, July 2005, Flanders. Well, all right, there you have it now. I've got the fan on, by the way, because it's really hot here. And it sort of rolls some of the sweat out of my body. But doesn't sound too loud. That turns out to be a 15-minute recording. Not too bad for those of you who can still stand to listen to me. As long as I can stand to listen to myself. The tragedy of the mother, let me tell you about this. Now this is heart-to-heart stuff. This is as heart-to-heart as it gets in the instruction of the main Turton. Now I picked up the Lucifer Sophia theme through the Gnostic Sabotage talks, and I realized that I really wanted to focus on some Gnostic correction. You know, that's what I do, right? It's the job of a Gnostic to correct what is not true and what is wrongly or erroneously stated, either by intention or out of sheer stupidity and laziness. So, okay, I've given myself the mission. I'm going to show that the true Lucifer is Sophia. What a beautiful message that is. And as I was looking into that and started to write the first draft and put forth these 10 points, which I believe I mentioned in a recent mailing to you all, this notion of the tragedy of the mother. And I went looking on the internet for an image of that particular one image, which I think comes from a bas-relief in a German museum. It's found in Themis by Jane Ellen Harrison, or it's found in her Prolegomena. I don't know which. And that is the image that you see in this article. In this essay. On the left you have Athena, and she's reaching out to embrace a child who comes up from the depths and is given to her from the depths of the earth. And overseeing this act of transmission, if you will, is Kecrops, the male guardian of the mysteries. With the gesture of silence, the sheaf of cut wheat, the serpent tail of the initiates who are adepts of Kundalini, both erotic and mystical. And I really wanted to see this image once again. It's not in his image. It's one of the few images at the head of a section of the book. And I wanted to tell you, the name of that child. You see, our mother, the Aeon Sophia, the planetary animal mother, has two children. Now, one of these children was produced not by biological reproduction or even any analogy to it. It was produced by the ecstatic dance, the tantric dance, if you will, the aeonic tango dance of Sophia and Thelete in the Pleroma. Previous to the emergence of this Earth, and previous to the emergence of any other Earth-like planet upon which the Anthropos came to be seated. So the first child of our mother is the Anthropos. Pre-terrestrial conception, if you will. Pre-terrestrial design. In the Pleroma. And our Divine Mother has also another child. And this is the child shown in this bas-relief. And the name of that child is Iachos. 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 That's the name of that child. And the word Iachos, there's a K, but it almost slips away. Iachos. The name of that child was sung ecstatically by the crowds who walked from Athens to Eleusis for the celebration of the lesser mysteries in the springtime. That is the child of the mysteries. The mysteries are that child. The mysteries of the organic light are the other child of our Divine Mother. That child was born of the earth, and it was born out of the perception of human animals devoted to the mother. Do you see that? It was born out of the dedication and devotion of human animals dedicated to the mother. You see? And that child, that very, very special child of the mysteries, was represented as a child just in the same way that Jesus the Christ, or whatever you want to call that monstrosity of human imagination, was represented as a child in the manger. This is a real child. Behold the real child. Behold the child that matters. Behold the child that holds the future of humanity. Iachos. That is the true child of the mysteries. So what I want to tell you now is, what is the tragedy of the mother? And that tragedy is that both her children have been abandoned by humanity. Humanity has abandoned itself, and as far as I'm concerned, although I don't like to use this syntax, and as you know, I resist it, it deserves everything that's coming to it, the worst imaginable it deserves, because humanity has abandoned itself. Or to say the same thing otherwise, the human species, the human animals of this anthropine species, have abandoned their own identity, which is the Anthropos. You know, you may recall that I said in the nav briefing, The Look of the Anthropos, which featured that photograph of a blonde Romani child, one of many abandoned children on the planet of abandoned children. You may recall that I said in that briefing that the Anthropos is just a look. It's something that is held in a look. So the Anthropos is something given in a look and something seen in a look. That's all it is. If you have a sense of solidarity with the Anthropos and you carry it, then you embody the Anthropos by the demonstration of this look. And people don't look at each other in a humane way anymore. Many billions of people around this planet do not. So that's what I mean by having abandoned their humanity. So the Anthropos, the first child of the Aeon Sophia, has been abandoned, and as well A great tragedy entails the story of the mysteries, as you know, and I do carry that tragedy marked upon myself and my character and even upon my face. And I'm tired of carrying that tragedy and the sorrow that goes along with it. But that sorrow of the mother is a reality when you feel her body and feel yourself as a living instrument of her body. Well, you can't help but feel it. Don't want to drown in it, of course, but it is there and it's immense. So I reserve as the topic for my next talk either one or the other of these two themes, the true Lucifer is Sophia, which is a correction of a vast delusion and disinfo concerning the identity of Lucifer. And if I can find continuity, it's a little difficult these days, I will present a recording on the tragedy of the mother. So, until we meet again on these airwaves.